Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's gripping installment of the Unforgiving 60. I'm here with Tim Curtis. G'day, Tim.
G'day, Ben.
Now, Tim, you are... I was going to say you are a triathlete, but I'm looking at you and you're clearly not. You've done half an Ironman triathlon.
Yes, I'll make up the other half at the end of the year.
Good. And so, done a bit of swimming?
Yes, grew up a competitive swimmer.
What's a big swim session for you?
4Ks.
Double it.
That's 8Ks.
Double it again.
16.
Double it again.
A little bit more. Well, we know that the English Channel is 32 kilometres. I'll cut the math out of it.
Double that.
64 kilometres.
A double crossing of the English Channel. Our guest this week, Sam Penny, that's what he's training for. He is a pretty interesting dude. He's got a number of amazing accomplishments, not just in the pool, but ranging from making cheese all the way through to some pretty incredible feats of endurance.
Let's get on with the show.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Tim Curtis.
G'day, Ben.
G'day, Tim. And Tim and I are joined today by Sam Penny. Sam, how are you?
I'm fantastic. It's so great to be with you, boys.
Thank you. It is awesome to be chatting to you. Now, you and I have spoken a couple of times prior to this, and I'm really keen to explore a number of the topics that we spoke about previously. But before we get into the boring stuff, I want to hear about cheese.
Cheese, my God. Yes, about 4 years ago, a Navy friend of mine and his partner and my partner were holidaying in Vanuatu, and we partied harder than seriously we've ever partied before in our lives. And whilst we're there, so Vanuatu, third world country, but it's ex-French, and the supermarket there, Au Bon Marché, is French. Mm-hmm. And in this supermarket, it had this amazing deli, a long cabinet full of terrines and foie gras and cheeses, all these French cheeses. And we came back to Australia wanting to, you know, recreate little parts of such an amazing holiday, only to find that you can't get good cheese these days. You know, everything, all the delis have gone, all the supermarkets have really started to, I guess, homogenize a lot of the produce that we're having day to day. And so when we recognized that, you know, there isn't really a good cheese offering, we decided to start cheese therapy. And basically what we do is each month we fly in cheese from around the world, chop it up, and then we send it out to people's homes around the country. And that's cheese therapy. So simple, but no one was doing it. And it was just something that we had to do because we really needed it ourselves.
That's a cool story. And I certainly, the first thing that springs into my mind when I think Vanuatu is not cheese, but that's pretty cool that you found the holy grail of cheese over there.
Well, it's amazing. You know, when you're in certain places, you know, how come a third world country can do this, but we can't do this in the first world? And, you know, it just did not make sense to us. And so we just had to make it happen.
Now, Sam, away from cheese and onto some of your other pursuits, it seems like you are making a habit of collecting what you call Everest moments. I'm really interested in that concept of having that kind of stretch goal that initially may seem insurmountable, but you can eventually work towards. Has that been a conscious thing for you, always to have that stretch goal?
For me, what I'm always doing, and when I look back on my life, you know, as a teenager, this is what I was always doing, looking for some really unique things that really challenged me personally. You know, I took up triathlons, you know, in the 80s when nobody knew what triathlon was. I did some mountain racing on a race called Pomona King of the Mountain on the Sunshine Coast in Australia. And that race there, I was the youngest person for 3 years running, and it was broadcast on Wide World of wide world of sport back in the heyday of when great sports were on TV. And then I guess I finished school, sort of finished uni, and then got into very much a life of complacency, you know, where you've got to just, you know, do your job, turn up day in, day out, you know, go to your lectures if it's uni, turn up to your job. You know, I was a civil engineer. And then you get married, you have kids, and you become quite complacent. But then you get to a point where you just remember where you were as a kid. And, you know, for me, I just wanted to challenge myself again. I just wanted to feel alive. And so the first part of it was just getting fit. And I just wanted to get fit because I felt that, you know, life was better than sitting on the couch just drinking wine. I love drinking wine, but perhaps I needed a good excuse to drink wine. So I get out, I get fit, you know, I started cycling and then I started doing that competitively. And looking back on my teenage years and also the last perhaps 10 years, 15 years of my life, I haven't gone out searching for Everest moments. I've gone out searching to be better than what I was last week. And, you know, to be better than what I was last week means that I need somewhere to be directed. And so whether that is, you know, getting faster in the pool, you know, one of my goals, I want to swim under a minute for 100 meters freestyle. You know, I'm 45 years old. I've never done that before in my life, but I'm at 60.11. I'm so close.
You can round that down, can't you?
Oh, I know, but the records, you know, you can go onto the internet and the internet shows everything. So I can't, unfortunately, because I would, don't worry. Being an engineer, I can round anything off. You know, sort of, I started to, I needed purpose to my training. I need a goal to give me direction with my training. I can't just go out and say swim 4 days a week or 5 days a week or go running or something like that. I need something to aim for. And so I started swimming about 5 years ago because I had a back injury and I had to give up cycling. And so I basically did it as rehab. So the first goal was just to do masters racing, which I absolutely loved. You know, nothing better than lining up against an 80-year-old woman and beating her.
Nothing worse than the other way around, though, when they do you.
So masters racing was a lot of fun. But then I started to get into some ocean racing because living on the Sunshine Coast here, it is beautiful coastline. But it was killing me. I was only ever used to swimming 50 meters, 100 meters, and then I'd go out and do a 1 kilometer ocean race. And my first kilometer ocean race, I think, was 3 years ago, and it absolutely killed me. It was horrid, but I just wanted to get better at that. And so I started down that path of, well, let's see how we go with this ocean racing stuff. But with the ocean racing, with, you know, 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers, whatever the distance, what I don't like about it is it's a long way, and it takes, you know, maybe it's 15 minutes of effort compared to 50 meters where it's, you know, over and done in 26 seconds. So I love the short stuff because the longer stuff just hurts for too long. And so I basically just progressed my swimming in a way that it was starting to open horizons for me. And I could see in my mind that, you know, there were so many opportunities. And then a couple of years ago, I've always been fascinated with people who swim the English Channel. That was just, I just always found that absolutely remarkable. You know, I think back to the days of, you know, people like Susie Maroney, who had done some amazing things. And just the concept of swimming from one country to another across wild waters just really intrigued me. So here I was as a 50-meter swimmer, 100-meter swimmer, just going, you know what? I reckon I could swim the English Channel. And everybody was just all of a sudden just going, you're crazy, you're mad. You can't do that. And I think it's sort of like a red flag to a bull when someone says, you can't do that. Oh, yes, let me just show you. And so then I just basically created my team. And I just, yep, I'm going to swim the English Channel, organized my boat. David Walliams from Little Britain, the actor from Little Britain, he swam the English Channel. And he's got a great video on YouTube that I watched. And so I was just going, well, bugger it. If David Walliams can swim the English Channel, so can I. And I chose his boat, which was the Viking Princess. And off I went. So boat was organized. I then realized quite quickly that I actually had no idea what I was doing. So I got a support team. So my first point of call was to get a coach. And funnily enough, the world record holder for the English Channel actually lives about an hour from me. It's a guy called Trent Grimsey, and he trains people to swim the English Channel. So this year, for example, he had about 8 swimmers this year. Last year, he had about 13, 14 swimmers. And so I set up a meeting with him, and basically he just provided my whole program, which was an 18-month program. I then set up my nutritionist, a lady called Tara Diversi in Cairns, because I realised that nutrition is a big part for an 11, 12-hour swim. Yeah. And then I needed a head support person in London, a guy called Tim Denyer. And so basically I just surrounded myself with the people who have been there before, who've done it, but also had the experience of a lot of other people.
Mm.
And I just... that gave me a huge amount of confidence. And whatever these people did, because, you know, I'm paying these people, whatever these people told me to do, I would do it. And that's something I've always done. Whenever I've got a coach, I always do exactly what they tell me to do, because who am I to argue?
It's really interesting you talking about that, having that vision, setting that goal, but that belief that other people can do it, I can do it as well. My brother Dan actually ended up writing a book called Average 70 Kilogram Dickhead, which was basically just saying that, you know, people can achieve stuff. You know, it's not superhuman folk that go out and do these things. Have you got any theories on why we lose that childlike sense of aspiration as we get older? We tend to, as you said before, just resign ourselves to these sort of slow, comfortable deaths without challenging ourselves in the way that we did as kids.
I think, you know, we start to get, you know, we breed complacency. Mm. You know, we're designed, and particularly for those of us who go through the university system, are basically, you know, led into the machine where we're in there to really spend our days just, you know, fulfilling a task, which gives us very little time to think, to dream, to sort of ponder what else could be. And, you know, I spent all of 18 months as a civil engineer, and I really did not like being an engineer. And it was basically because as a construction engineer, I'd turn up to site and fight with people who are 30, 40 years older than me. I would come in with fresh ideas, new ideas, better ways of doing things. Mm. But these old foremen would always just, you know, basically shout me down and just go, we've done this the same
this
way.
This is how it's always been done.
Why are we going to change it? And I think, you know, after a lot of sort of knockbacks and, you know, getting sort of told that you've got to, you know, wait your time and everything like that, then I feel that we start to really lose a lot of what life actually is, you know, sort of what makes a fulfilling life and what makes a happy life. And I think it's one of those things, you know, people talk about the midlife crisis, but it's such an important thing that all of a sudden people realize that, hang on, you know, the last 20 years haven't been that fun and they haven't been that fulfilling. And I could do things so much better, and I could be so much happier if I just changed the way I looked at life.
And it's funny, we spoke about, and I'm using your phrase here, the Everest moments before, but often you'll see people, they'll achieve what they always thought they wanted in terms of status or, you know, the fancy house or financial security or whatever it might be, and then have this real anti-climax that, Jesus, is that it, you know? And this constant goal setting thing is something I'm quite intrigued in, and it seems that it's something you've done sort of throughout, and you one look at your website and you can see there's a whole bunch up there for the world to see.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, I love, you know, basically having a whole, I guess, series of things to look forward to. And I can't have a goal that's in, you know, 2 years' time. I might have something in 2 years' time, but I need some interim, you know, six monthly things to get me excited, to, you know, steps that really challenge me along the way that lead to this ultimate thing. You know, I've set myself the I guess, challenge of doing a double crossing next year in the English Channel. And they say that, you know, because it is hard to swim the English Channel. It's not easy. swimming a double, they reckon, is eight times harder. And, you know, basically, I've just had to work out, right, I've got 50 weeks to get all my training in. I've got to, you know, get myself physically in the best shape to go for 22 hours as possible. Mentally, I need to toughen myself up. I need to work on my nutrition. I need to get the kilometers into my shoulders so that, you know, my training, I don't blow out a shoulder, but also during the actual swim, I don't blow anything out. You know, I worked out that between now and my swim in July next year, I will have done 1,050,000 strokes. That's a lot of shoulder rotations.
Yep.
Arguably more than the human body's designed to do in a lifetime, but we'll leave that with the physios. Okay, and so you've this, what would seem to the layperson, certainly seems to me an insurmountable goal, like swimming the channel twice. You mentioned before breaking it down into small steps, and I've heard you speak before about this going all the way down to these micro steps when you're doing an open water swim, about counting to 10 and repeating again. Well, can you talk to the importance of that for yourself in terms of having those tiny little goals that you can achieve, acknowledge, and then sort of set on to the next one?
Yeah, certainly. So my training program is a 50-week program that Trent Grimsey gave me. And basically what he's given me is every single week of, you know, however many swim sessions, what my open water swims are on the weekend. And they're broken down into 4-week blocks. So I can see sort of what I'm doing over the whole 50 weeks, but also how it builds every, you know, 3 weeks, rest week, 3 weeks, rest week. But then I know exactly what I'm going to do today. And the approach that I take with this is, what am I going to do today? Rather than sort of thinking about how big the task is of, you know, 50 weeks of swimming, what do I have to do today? And that's all I ever focus on, because everything's already mapped out. I don't need to worry about anything over the next 50 weeks. So today, just say, for example, if I'm in the ocean, and at the moment I'm only doing 2-hour open water swims in the ocean on the weekends, because it's a big ramp up over the next, you know, sort of just short of a year. And so when I'm in the ocean, I then break my swim down into segments. So here at Mooloolaba on the Sunshine Coast, I've got this course which is a 2K lap, 1 kilometer over and back across the bay and the ocean. And so that allows me to break my 2 hours, or even when I do my longest swim next year is 16 hours, I can break these swims down into over and back, which is 30 minutes, break it down again to 15, which is, you know, over, then basically a turn. But then in between each of those 1 kilometer, 15 minute sections, I am able to then shut my mind completely off and I just count to 10. And so basically I count my strokes, count to 10, and then start again, count to 10. When I completely shut my mind off, I sometimes forget to stop at 10 and I might then stop at 20 or 30. But I just continually do that. And so, you know, it's probably the most common question, you know, how do you get through, say, a 6-hour swim? You know, what do you think about? Don't you get bored? Can you listen to music? And I don't get bored because I'm not thinking about anything and the 6 hours just completely goes. It's for those people who are really good at meditation, being able to completely free your mind and turn it off and focus on your breath. This is exactly what I'm doing, but in a very sort of long format. And so by just focusing on the 10 strokes I'm doing now, that, you know, the counting to 10, I'm quickly at, you know, the 1K mark, then the 30 minute sort of turnaround. And then the time just flies across these long swims.
It really reminds me, we draw our inspiration in this podcast from a couple of poems, obviously, If with the Unforgiving Minute, but also this Golden Journey to Samarkand by Flecker, which talks about we are the pilgrim's master, we shall go always a little further. And I've always really, that's always resonated with me, just that, you know, any endeavour is just a combination of one foot in front of another, one stroke after another. And it kind of sounds like you've almost crystallized that in terms of your counting to 10 and repeating and very much the mindfulness aspects of just putting yourself in the moment and keeping going a little further.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's not always, you know, blissful, you know, listening to my breath and everything like that. There are times where I'm just, you know, hating it. But I've got this quote, and, you know, particularly when I'm in the pool, doing my swim squad. So I train with a bunch of 15-year-old kids. Socially, they're not very good.
You can't have a beer afterwards with
it. It's not the most exciting swim session, but my coach there is the National Open Water coach, Michael Sage. And, you know, these guys just, I just get absolutely hammered. I'm the last in the lane and it hurts. And pretty much every session I do in the pool, I always think to myself, oh, I could just hop out. But then what always pops into my head is this phrase, I didn't come this far to only come this far. And, you know, if I did hop out, you know, then that would give me an excuse to hop out next time and to hop out every other time after that, or to skip a session. And so I've never skipped a swim session. I've never hopped out because I didn't come this far to only come this far.
But what about the power of failure? Now, we don't often talk about this. Everyone likes the success story and that sort of thing. Certainly in my own experience, nowhere near as impressive as yours on the physical side, but the things I've failed, you know, pulling out of that race when it got a bit hard or quitting when it got a bit painful, that's the stuff that really spurs me on to do it next time. Have you got a similar sort of experience, or do you just never quit?
Recently I did a running race because swimmers are the worst runners in the world. So I just thought, hey, I'll do a running race. And I did this thing called Last One Standing. And I only did this about 2-3 weeks ago. It's called a backyard ultra. This is like the new phenomenon in ultra marathons. And I looked at this race. So basically, in essence, you run 6.7 kilometers on this really easy course. If you've ever heard of the Barclay Marathons over in the US, the insane bastard who created the Barclay Marathons also created this format. And basically, this format is to completely destroy people. So you run 6.7 kilometers, which for anybody, you know, who can shuffle or walk or run, you can make 6.7 kilometers. The thing is, next hour you have to line up and do it again, and then you have to do it again, and then do it again, and basically until you destroy yourself. And so the winner is literally the last one standing. And I looked at this format and I just thought, you know, if I can just get some time on my... I spent about 2 months of running. I've never been a runner in my life. I hate running. I've got a short, stumpy body. I am not suited to that sport at all. But I looked at it and I just thought, hang on, everybody there is an ultra marathon runner, but this isn't an ultra marathon. And so the concept of this thing just really excited me, because I just thought, yeah, I reckon I could crack the code for this thing. Nobody said you had to be a runner, but everybody thinks that you do. So once again, everybody's saying you can't do that. It's for ultra marathon runners. And so so I just figured it's about time on my feet, getting my strategy right. So my strategy was shuffle 1 minute, walk 1 minute, and get me in with 8 minutes of rest. The fast guys were getting about 20 minutes more than me, but I got to 13 hours. And by the end of 13 hours, my legs had started to completely blow up. And that was 87 kilometers. I went out on my 14th lap, tried about five times to run, and I was just, no, I can't do this. And I pulled out. And I could have completed the lap and, you know, perhaps walked it or even come good halfway through, but I pulled out. And over the last 3 weeks, I've kind of been kicking myself that I failed. You know, I didn't give myself the opportunity to not make the cutoff. I just pulled out and failed. And it's been playing on my mind for the last 3 weeks that I can't let this happen. You know, when I'm swimming the double crossing next year, I can't just pull out. Yeah, you know, for me to pull out is as simple as touching the side of the boat, and that then basically disqualifies the swim. So it's very easy to just pull out. This one has really been playing on my mind. You know, 87 kilometers was more than three times more than I'd ever gone in my life, but still, I put it down as a fail.
Unfinished business, do you think, Sam?
Well, for some stupid reason, I signed up again for next year. But it's about 3 weeks after my double crossing, so my chances of getting time on my feet will be limited. But Lazarus Lake, the guy who created this format, is coming to Brisbane for it, and I just want to meet him. I have turned into, I think, a bit of a Lazarus Lake groupie. The guy is just nuts. You know, if you don't know anything about Barkley Marathon, you need to watch the documentary on it. Basically, it's a run designed that nobody could ever finish, and in 30 years, I think only 13 people have ever completed it.
All right, let's get to territory that's a little more familiar, and let's dive into the English Channel.
Okay.
Now, some stats, and correct me if I get any of these wrong. It's a 21 mile or 32 kilometer swim, and people typically complete it between 7 hours and 27 hours. Susie Moroney did it in 8 hours 29, and interestingly, the first person to ever swim the channel swam it in 1875. Now, you've had a successful channel swim. How much do you think that that is going to stand you in good stead for a double channel swim?
I was actually only thinking about this morning. On pool deck today, there was a gentleman called Doug Frost on pool deck. Now, he is Ian Thorpe's coach. And he was there just to observe our squad. And I was thinking about how, you know, what this guy's been able to achieve, particularly with Ian Thorpe, and then thinking about how I had achieved the English Channel and how much confidence I gained from that. And whilst I was swimming and also suffering, getting flogged by these 15-year-olds, I was thinking to myself that if someone said, Sam, I want you to swim the English Channel tomorrow, I could. Even though I'm only 4 weeks into my training, I could go out and swim the English Channel because I know what it's like. There isn't a barrier there anymore. Prior to me swimming the English Channel, there was this huge barrier of just thinking, you know, this is just, you know, this is massive. Half the people who attempt it fail. There's nowhere to hide in the English Channel. I didn't know sort of if I was going to be a blubbering idiot or, you know, will I end up in the fetal position? But I ended my swim, hopped back on the boat, and recovered in about 5 minutes, and just felt like I could have swum it again. 4 days later, we were at Holiday Inn in France, and felt that if a spot came up, I could have swum the English Channel on that day. And even today, even though I haven't got the training of what most English Channel swimmers have, I could go and swim the English Channel now. And in terms of the confidence that it gives me for my double next year, it's brilliant. You know, a lot of people who, every year there's people who try and swim a double crossing. It's only about once every 2 or 3 years that someone actually makes it. And a lot of the people who try and do a double crossing haven't swum a single crossing before. They don't realize how hard just that one way is. But having that confidence now of I know what it's like to swim into France and touch the French cliffs, but also then, you know, having to swim back to the boat, I know what it's going to feel like to turn around.
So my big question about a double crossing, do you have to tumble turn at France?
I don't know why everybody asked me this question. So the ideal place for me to land is a place called Cap Grenet, and it's cliffs with a lighthouse up the top. Now, to complete a single crossing, you have to clear the water, and even for a double crossing, you have to clear the water. So I basically need to climb up onto a rock, make sure my feet are out of the water, and I'm only going to spend about a minute and a half at the most on that rock, and then I'll dive back in. My support guy, Tim Denyer, will hopefully be right there with a quick bit of food for me to eat, and then start swimming back. But if I was to stay on that rock too long, you start to get cold. And your body starts to seize up, and also then the demons start to enter your mind, which is going, oh, I actually don't feel like doing this.
So I know no one can touch you at that halfway point before you get back in the water, and you can't touch the boat or anyone else, but can you receive some form of support when you're standing on France?
Yeah, so basically someone can hand me food or hand me some more of that that grease that you see channel swimmers always covered in. So they can hand me stuff. They just can't physically touch me.
Okay. So your first single swim, I say that as if you might do it again. Well, you will do it again at least once. What time did you swim the channel in last time?
So I was in 11 hours and 2 minutes.
Fascinating, isn't it? So actually, the record holders, Australians and New Zealanders, monopolised the records. And Trent Grimsey, who you mentioned before, swam it in 6 hours 55. That being the case, what do you think you might do the double in? Do you have any expectation on a time?
Yeah, look, I've been working a lot on my speed. When I swam the English Channel last year, I swam it in August 2018. I was actually meant to swim in August 2019. I did a cold water camp with Trent in April last year down in Melbourne. And after that, about a week later, Trent gave me a call and just said, Sam, a spot's come up August this year. We think you're ready for it. And no pressure, but I think you should take it, but have the weekend to think about it. After we hung up, about 2 minutes later, a training program came through. and so my channel swim last year was done on 3 months of training. This time I've got a whole 50 weeks proper training program. But over the last year since my channel swim, I've been swimming nonstop. So I've been working on a lot of my speed, my endurance speed. And so, look, if I can... I reckon I'll go anywhere between 20 and 24 hours. You don't know. It's just you don't know what the conditions are going to be like. You don't know if, perhaps you get seasick. You know, I've never been seasick, but a lot of people, do get seasick, or they start to just, you know, throw up all of their feeds. It's a really tough thing to sort of try and even contemplate what time it's going to be. But if I was going to put a number on it, 22 hours.
So the record for two ways is held by a New Zealander who did it in 16 hours 10. And actually, interestingly, the record for a female, Susie Moroney, the Australian, who did it in 17 hours 14. Silly follow-up question, but maybe necessary to ask it. How do you take a break? How do you take a rest in that 20 to 24 hours of swimming?
Yeah, so basically the only time we stop is to have a feed. And our feeds are all liquid. A bottle on a rope gets basically thrown at us. And a good feed is 10, 15 seconds. So every half hour, I'll stop for 15 seconds. I'm actually sort of sculling on my, you know, basically on my back kicking. So I'm still moving forward whilst I'm sculling this drink. And then I'll just go again. And the reason we don't have big stops is because in the English Channel, there's some massive tides. And if you've ever seen the track of someone who swims the English Channel, they're always generally just going with a massive north, like a giant sine wave, basically. They head north and then they head south on these massive tides.
Mm. Well, the record for the number of single crossings is owned by a Brit, Kevin Murphy, at 34, and the most amount of male two-way crossings is 3. Any desire to try and break either of those records?
Well, after a double, I'll have 3 crossings. Chloe McArdle overnight just did her 31st. She's an Australian swimmer. Her 31st crossing, and she's done a double and a
triple.
A triple. Mm-hmm. The thing about, I don't feel like I want to go back and do the same swim again. You know, when I say I didn't come this far to only come this far, you know, also part of that is when you reach the top of the mountain, find another mountain. Mm. And, you know, for me, swimming the English Channel, you know, which you say is the Everest of swimming, that's exactly how I look at it. You know, well, I've climbed that mountain. Now I want to go and find a harder mountain to climb. Mm. And so I don't feel the need to go back and keep, you know, repeating the same thing that I've always done. I want to find stuff that's going to challenge me, something that's really going to stimulate me and push me even further.
Mm. And Ben, there's hope for you because the oldest swimmer was 73 years old when they swam the channel. Now, Sam, little tangent, but we understand that you also had some form of your professional career in hair and beauty. Does that stand you in good stead at all for a channel swim?
Oh, hell no. I think what it really gave me was tolerance and patience. It's a very interesting industry to be in, and certainly one I'm not going to revisit.
Mm. On your Facebook page, you famously have a chest freezer full of ice, and you do different things in and around that particular freezer. Very Wim Hof. Do you follow the Wim Hof method?
No, it's interesting. Everybody, after I started my chats from the chest freezer vlogs on my Facebook page, everybody started, you know, saying, "Oh, Sam, are you the new Australian Wim Hof?" I thought, "Who the hell is Wim Hof?" And I've since gone and found out who he is. Basically, chats from the chest freezer. I converted a chest freezer into a plunge pool, like obviously a very tiny plunge pool. And I keep it between 0 and 4 degrees. And so I go and sit in that for anywhere between, say, sort of 5 minutes. And the longest, I think, was about 25 minutes. Basically, just go in there and chill. But it's great for my cold water acclimatization.
Oh, boy. That is, one of the hardest things, I think, I've ever done, trying to get my face under the water. Feels like someone has stabbed something right into the middle of my forehead. It is so hard.
for, you know, the English Channel's only 16 degrees usually. And so it could be 13, 14 degrees. It could be 18 degrees. But you need to be prepared for the worst. And with swimming the channel and all the things that I do, I always do my best to be able to control the things I can control. And one of those is cold water acclimatization. Last year, you know, I only had a 3-month lead up to my English Channel. My nutritionist made me put on 10 kilos in 2 months. And it was just absolutely foul to put on that much weight, particularly when you're in a heavy training program. Did it, but then for the 6 months following that, it absolutely destroyed my back. And so this year, I couldn't afford to put on the weight like that. It really hurt my back. And, you know, particularly with four kids, the last thing you want is to, you know, and four young kids, you know, our youngest is only seven. The last thing you want is to not be able to play with them. And so I basically, in conversation with my nutritionist, who has also swum the channel, we basically worked out a program of being in the chest freezer every second day to build up the brown fat so I don't need to put on the weight. And the thing with brown fat is that it's the same sort of fat that what babies have. Babies don't shiver. And brown fat, when it burns at a high temperature, and so it keeps you warm. And so by doing this, then I avoid putting on the 10 kilos, but also stay warmer, leaner, and then also faster for the double.
Anything related to breathing in the chest freezer?
Oh, boy, I tell you what, when you jump into it at, you know, sort of close to zero, you have no breath. It's extremely hard. It takes, particularly if you have a break for about a week or 2 weeks from it, it's quite hard to get into a breathing pattern. But when I've been doing it continuously for, you know, every second day, I hop in, basically submerge myself up to my neck, and I can easily control my breathing. And by controlling my breathing and controlling my mind, I then don't feel cold. Yeah, I notice that it's cold, but it doesn't feel cold, if that makes sense. Yeah, the temperature of this water, just imagine an esky full of ice and water, and you plunge your hand in to get that last beer. You know, you've got to dig around for it. That's the same temperature as what this chest freezer is. So to pretty much everybody, it's very bloody cold. But when I hop in it, because I've accustomed myself to it, I just find it actually now quite a pleasurable experience. And I think it's because I'm controlling my mind, controlling my breathing. And I think it's just another one of those things that people have an excuse to call me mad for.
Sam, tell us about the ice mile.
Man, the ice mile. This is one of the stupid things, probably the most stupid thing I've ever done. To get myself ready for my double crossing of the English Channel next year, one of my fears of it was developing hypothermia and not being able to handle the cold. So I just thought, what better way than to do an ice mile? And so an ice mile is swimming a mile, so 1,600 metres, mm-hmm. in water less than 5 degrees. Basically, you have to do a 1 kilometre qualifier first, and then you can do your mile. So I went down to Lake Krakenback in the Snowy Mountains here in Australia, and did my 1 kilometre qualifier. Mm-hmm. And I'd never swum in water so cold. I'd been doing my chest freezer cold water acclimatization. So I'd been in the water physically like that, but I'd never actually put my head under the water. And I set off to start this thing. And as soon as I put my head under the water, I just couldn't control my breathing. I was doing this like a double inhalation. And you know, the swimming part is so natural to me that, you know, turning my head and I get into such a rhythm. But on about the third stroke, I gulped in this massive amount of icy cold water. And the water temp was 4 degrees. It was blowing about 45 kilometers an hour. It was just bitterly cold. And then for the next probably 300 meters, I was just trying to cough all this icy water out of my lungs. My body started to go numb. And what I was really worried about was half the lake was frozen over. And so I was really worried about running into this ice and cutting myself. I had a guy next to me on a kayak as my safety person. But during this 1 kilometer swim, I had these three bouts of dizziness. And if you've ever been swimming and you start to get dizzy, it is a really scary feeling.
Mm.
And I stopped each time and a couple of strokes of breaststroke, and then the dizziness went away and then I'd start again. But it kept recurring, and I got this 1 kilometer done, and I was really scared. I thought that I was close to passing out, and then the thoughts of dying whilst you're in the water is a really scary place to be. And then I really started to doubt myself. I was in the car trying to warm up. We had the car running the whole swim, trying to warm myself up. We went back to Cooma, where we were staying that night, and our observer, who was the guy on the kayak, was staying with us. He was also Australia's first person to do an ice mile, and I was eventually the sixth person. But he was telling me that night how two people died last year, and I just looking at him, you know, this is after how I was telling him that I had these bouts of dizziness and I was starting to feel a little bit scared about it and really doubting myself. And then he tells me that I had the worst night's sleep ever. I had about 30 minutes sleep. And all I could think about was there was a real chance that I could die. And I was nervous as hell. Now, Helen, my partner, has been through all of my training. She's seen how my body reacts after being in the chest freezer for 25 minutes. She knows how I rewarm. You know, she's seen me, you know, all through my English channel and everything else. But and she also knows how much of a bastard I can be before a race when I get those sort of, you know, those race jitters.
Mm.
But on this occasion, I was just silent, and it was really starting to concern her. And I was really scared. I also had our kids there. And everything was starting to become extremely real for me. We turned up to Lake Krakenback, and when we got to Lake Krakenback, it was snowing. The water, it had been raining overnight. The water, so all the snow had washed off the mountains into the lake. The water had dropped to 3.9 degrees. The air with the wind chill was minus 2.2. And here I was sitting in this car, sort of thinking back on the day before, thinking about what Wyatt had said to me about seeing two people die do this last year over in Europe. And then all of a sudden, there was this break in the clouds and the sun came out. And then I realized that I was fit. You know, I was fast for a mile. I had done all the training I needed to do. And so I started to get a lot of confidence in my preparation. And, you know, the thing is, I try and control everything I can physically control. I can't control the temperature of the water or the air, but I can control my fitness. I can control my speed, my ability to sustain these cold temperatures. And so then all of a sudden this calmness came over me. And I hopped out of the car, went to the side of the lake and just, you know, basically stripped off. There, I had about 10 friends there who were acting as safety support, and not one of them touched the water. Didn't even put a finger in to feel how cold it was. And I just walked into this water, and I remember walking into this water and looking up, and the snow line was only about 50 meters above where we were, and there was this snow coming down, this really light snow. And just thinking to myself how amazing this opportunity was for me to, firstly, to get this far, to be able to walk into this water. And I strode into this water, and it felt beautiful. I splashed water on my body to sort of get my body, you know, ready for it. And the water didn't feel cold. And then I set off, started stroking away. And once again, third stroke in, dolved in this damn water again. And I thought I would have learnt from the day before. But I did this, I did this swim. I didn't have any of the issues the day before, and I felt confident the entire time. And I hopped out of the water. You know, by the end, your core body temperatures really plunge. You got, you know, some pretty severe hypothermia. But I ended up with the 12th fastest time in the world for the ice mile.
Wow.
And I did 25.04. Took me about an hour to stop shivering. My shivering was just, it was seriously violent. But just the experience of it, and, you know, in my mind, facing death was something completely, it was completely new to me. You know, and so many people have faced death, but I never had. And just the mental strength that it required to get me through this, but also the physical strength as well, to be able to turn my arms over when, you know, they felt like logs. And, you know, by about halfway through, I couldn't feel my face, my arms, my legs. You know, I had to swim through these patches of reeds, and every time I swam through them, they felt like razor blades on my body.
Mm.
But got to the end, and just the sense of achievement from this really, really stupid thing was immense. And, you know, still, that is perhaps the craziest thing I've ever done, but I am just so proud of what I achieved, the calmness that I was able to obtain right before I swam, and, you know, having that as part of my preparation for my double channel crossing next year, I feel now I've controlled and taken control of the cold component of what that huge challenge is.
What about heart rate? Do you train to heart rate? Is it something that you monitor whilst either at rest, in the chest freezer, or in the water?
It's a bit hard when you're swimming to monitor your heart rate. On my long swims, I guess what it is, it's more knowing where you start to produce lactate in your body. And so I'm able to get to a position just below where my body starts to produce lactic acid. And at that point, I then know that I can keep going for hours and hours and hours. When we're in the pool, you know, we'll do heart rate checks at the end of each, you know, sort of at the end of each set. But generally it's more an understanding of how you can push your body, and what, you know, what is it that you actually need to push your body for. The only time I really monitor my heart rate is during my sleep every night. Mm. So I wear a watch that monitors my heart rate. And when I wake up in the morning, pretty much the very first thing that I do is see what my resting heart rate was. And that gives me a great indication of how great my sleep was, and how tired I am from my training.
And embarrass us all, what was your resting heart rate this morning?
A little bit higher, is about 44.
Okay, impressive. All right, Sam, we're going to transition into a section that we love. We call it Quick Questions, Quick Answers. We're going to fire a battery of questions at you in no particular order without constant vector.
Ooh.
Expect the unexpected.
Exciting.
All right, let's get underway. Sam, what are you most scared of?
Sharks.
That's very logical, very rational. But the beauty of the English Channel swim is that there pretty much are no sharks.
Well, that's exactly right. About a month ago, there was a cruise ship off the coast here at Mooloolaba. It was about 2 kilometres straight out into the ocean. And I took three friends out for a swim out to the cruise ship. And on the way out, we had to pass the shark nets. And we just decided, for shits and giggles, how about we actually dive under them rather than swim over the top of them? So we all dived under them, and we got to the other side, and then we realised, bugger me, we're on the side where the sharks are.
But also, if you can dive under a shark net, surely a shark can swim under it. It doesn't sound like an effective barrier.
Well, that's exactly right. And I took my GoPro with us, and actually, when we look back on the video, we didn't see the 3-metre hole in the shark net. So I wouldn't call them that effective. But sharks are something that they're there, and I've got this shark attack procedure in my mind. And so if I get bitten by a shark out in the ocean, and I've played this in my mind quite a lot when I'm on my long swims. If I get bitten by a shark, it's going to be a Mooloolaba. It's not going to be too big. It'll only bite a chunk out of my leg, or, you know, sort of just bite me on the side, let go. So I'll swim to the shore. I'll be only about 100 metres from the shore. So that'll take me about 60 seconds, maybe a minute 20 if one of my legs isn't working.
So that explains why you want to break a minute.
Exactly. And there will be someone walking along the beach. I will then give them Helen, my partner, give them Helen's mobile number, and I'll tell them to text her. Don't call her, because she never answers the bloody phone if she doesn't know the mobile. And text her, Sam's okay, he's just been bitten by a shark and he's going off to hospital, and then get the person to call the ambulance. That's my shark attack procedure.
I've heard you talk about that before in your Aunt Morehouse discussion. And I was talking with Tim about that just before we came on air. And it reminds me very much our parachute training school. So the Australian Army's parachute training school has a motto of knowledge dispels fear, which the idea being that, you know, there's some scary stuff out there, but if you've got a plan, if you've got a bit of knowledge, if you've thought it through, then you can rationalise that fear a bit.
Yeah, and so that, you know, with this, as irrational as it may be, it takes a lot of that fear away. You know, if something did happen, then I've got a way that will kick in that I'll deal with it, and it's, you know, something that I've played over in my head so much that if it was to happen, which it won't, but if it did happen, you know, the instinct should kick in.
Good tangent, but that's the end of tangents. Back to quick questions, quick answers.
I was actually just going to interject. We have never done a quick question. We ask one question, then talk for half an hour. Okay, quick question. What's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, wine. I love wine. But I've actually given up wine for a few months because I really need to focus on my training for this double crossing. It's such a big task. And I need to ensure that I turn up every single day in the best form I possibly can to every training session.
Goes well with cheese. If you could listen to music while you're swimming, what type of music would you listen to?
Ooh. The only time I ever listen to music whilst I'm, you know, perhaps doing anything remotely close to exercising is when I go for a walk along the beach, and I listen to the same album every single time. It's Pink Floyd's Piper at the Gates of Dawn. It's their very first album. Very psychedelic. It sort of gets more into your subconscious. And so if I was to swim, it perhaps would be something more psychedelic like that.
Mm. For 20 to 24 hours, that would be very repetitive.
When I do swim, though, I've always got the chorus of some crappy song in my head. You know, when you wake up and you've got some rubbish song? Yeah, every single time I go swimming in the ocean, I've got some song in my head. I only know half a line, and it just is on repeat for 6 hours.
I went for a run recently, which is an annual event, and my son, just before I left, a seven-year-old boy, played John Cena, the wrestler's theme song called The Time Is Now. Your time is up, my time is now. You can't see me, my time is now. It's the franchise where I'm shining now. You can't see me, my time is now. If you want a song to get stuck in your head and drive you nuts, I recommend that one.
Oh, I've got enough of those.
Sam, what's your favourite movie?
The Last Emperor.
If you had the ear of the world for a minute, what would you say to the world?
Live a happy life, and because everybody deserves to be happy, regardless of who they are. And I think that, you know, too many people are just so self-absorbed, trying to get the better of everybody else. I just wish that everybody could just, you know, recognize that everyone deserves happiness.
And so to follow on from that, for our very last question, how do you define happiness?
Happiness for me is just living a fulfilling life. You know, I always make sure that I've got time to spend with my kids. You know, this year I was coaching rugby for one of my boys. I love spending time with the kids. I love doing stuff with them. I love seeing them challenge themselves. I love watching people challenge themselves as well, regardless, you know, not just my kids. I love seeing people go out and try and achieve things. And that makes me really happy. You know, people who can just have a go. And it doesn't matter, you know, how small or how big it is. You know, when people have a go and they're trying new things and pushing themselves, that makes me really happy.
That's a great place to leave it, just having a go. July 2020 is the double crossing attempt by Sam Penny. Sam, thanks very much for being on the show. Don't think of sharks and don't think of John Cena.
I'm definitely not going to Google that John Cena song.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, guys.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.